As an adapting listener, you won't want to miss the Jewish Education Project's spring event on Tuesday, May 21st in New York City. Join us for an inspiring conversation on the role of education in strengthening Jewish identity, fortitude, and the Jewish future with film and stage actor and podcast host Josh Molina. You can register via the link in the show notes. Hi, everybody, and we are recording today's episode of Adapting on March 27, 2024. And we're focusing here on a topic which I believe has become almost a bit of a cliche, and that is the topic of Jewish pride. There are many people that I'm hearing today, especially in a post-October 7th world, but even beforehand, saying that the outcome of Jewish education should be for our young Jews especially to be proud of being Jewish. And we throw that word around as if it has no meaning and no context and no consequences. And today we're able to have a conversation with Ben M. Friedman, who is the founder of the Modern Jewish Pride Movement, who really is able to leverage his own experiences growing up as part of the LGBTQ+ community and what it meant to express pride as a young gay person, and then being able to make that translation into his own Jewish identity and what this could mean or should mean for the Jewish community today was actually really informative and also transformative for me in the way that I conceptualize this notion of Jewish pride. I think it's a really important episode, especially in a post-October 7th world. It talks about that we should be Jewish not because we are reacting to the events of October 7th or to anti-Semitism in the world today, but what are the really innate or the really intentional pieces of our own identities that we can cultivate so that we internalize what it means to be Jewish and then express that in an external way, which Ben has labeled as Jewish pride. I hope you enjoyed today's episode as much as I did.
This is Adapting, the Future of Jewish Education, a podcast from the Jewish Education Project, where we explore the big questions, challenges, and successes that define Jewish education. I'm David Breifman.
Ben M. Friedman is the founder of the Modern Jewish Pride Movement and the author of Jewish Pride, Rebuilding a People and Reclaiming Our Story, The Pursuit of Jewish Pride. So it's basically because of this title, Jewish Pride, that I wanted to talk to you today. So welcome and thanks for joining us, Ben, on Adapting.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here with you today.
So let's just get it out of the way and talk a bit about your journey and what got you to write a book about Jewish pride.
Sure. So I am from a very small community in the UK, in Scotland, in a city called Glasgow. And there were 5,000 Jews in the whole country. So I think my parents and the parents of my peers had to work really hard to be Jewish, which gave me a really strong Jewish identity. I also went to the only Jewish school in the country, which was an Orthodox elementary school. So I kind of got that religious upbringing as well, even if that's not the way I was specifically raised in my own home. So I had that experience and I was very proud to be Jewish, although I probably would never have used that language. I just was. Like, I just was a Jew, right? I really started considering my identity a little bit later when I was a teenager, when I came out as gay, or when I was really struggling with the idea of being gay. And it was in that journey that I understood something really fundamental, a lesson that I think all minority groups can learn, but specifically something I, as a gay person, and then later as a Jew, felt was that I had done nothing wrong. I felt like I was being punished by society for a crime I hadn't committed, and that crime, in their mind, or at least the way I perceived it, was being gay. So I was kind of working out my identity, and then the two fused in about 2018 when I was in the online community that was fighting Jeremy Corbyn, and I was watching, admiring the Jewish community in the UK, seeing that it was expressing Jewish pride, but also thinking about how Jew hatred impacts Jewish people. And I guess that internal dialogue led me to reflect on my experience pursuing gay pride. And then I asked myself, okay, what can Jews learn from this? And I kind of decided, and I don't think it was an aha moment, but I decided at some point that we also need a pride movement that would be distinct and would educate, inspire, and empower us in the way that other pride movements do those things for their respective communities.
All right, I got so many questions I want to follow up. Okay, maybe let's give a footnote to the audience who are primarily not from the UK. Let's talk about the James Corbyn moment and exactly what...
Not James. James is too nice a name for him.
Oh, Jeremy Corbyn, yes.
So Jeremy Corbyn was the leader of the Labour Party, Britain's opposition party, from 2015 to 2020. And he really, in my opinion, is a racist. He is a kind of classic British racist against Jews in that he kind of sees Jews as these foreign interlopers, and there was some statements he made that illuminated that idea. But also he was an anti-Zionist. So he really normalized left-wing Jew hatred. And I think what we're seeing in the United States and Australia, all over the world, so not just the UK, is partly a result of him. So he normalized this left-wing anti-Zionist dialogue. He is no longer leader of the Labour Party, but he's still a thorn in our side. He still pops up to make messages and calls for ceasefires whenever he feels the need.
So I want to get back to your whole nexus of your gay and your Jewish identity and how these two things coalesce later on in your life. But I think I want to go backwards before getting quite to that stage, because if I'm reading your biography correctly, and you'll tell me if I'm not, you were a Holocaust educator, or you had a big background in Holocaust education. I can't imagine that not having played a role in some of your own discovery and some of your own journey as well.
Absolutely. So I was a Holocaust educator. I first went to Auschwitz when I was 18 during a gap year in Israel. They took us from Israel back to Europe. But my journey with that really started a couple of years later when I worked for a Jewish organization in the UK, and we took trips from Glasgow to Poland, and we educated young Jewish kids from Glasgow about the Holocaust. And I think, of course, that gave me a grounding in terms of my identity. But I think really actually what it did is give me more of a grounding in knowledge. I felt very Jewish, but I never felt Jewish because of the Holocaust. And I think that's something really important. You know, when we have the later conversation about pride, we're not proud because of the Holocaust, because of October 7th, because of these things. We're proud and we understand that those things also happened to us. But what it did was give me an understanding of the long history of Jew hatred. Because, of course, the Holocaust didn't happen in a vacuum. So for years, I was learning and exploring and analysing, okay, what events led to the Holocaust, what happened in Europe, what happened in the world, which would enable 6 million Jews to be murdered. And I think that knowledge was very useful later on when I joined Twitter, especially to take part in the fight against Corbyn, because I had a historical understanding. You know, people were asking, why is this happening? Why is Jeremy Corbyn saying these things? And of course, there was a specific left-wing variant that he was, you know, espousing or part of, but it was also connected to the wider story. And I had that knowledge because of my years educating about the Holocaust. And I think I probably also understood very keenly and acutely the danger of Jew hatred. I think that there was, for a period perhaps, that Jews were willing to, you know, diminish it, say, well, you know, it's not that bad. But I was always so hyper aware, because of my work on the Holocaust, of what could happen.
Talk to us a bit about your gay identity. In terms of, you described it before as being marginalised or even victimised, and I want to better understand that, because I think where I want to get to in the conversation is, it's not necessarily a linear line between feeling being a victim and then espousing pride. So that's what I want to try and get at. But talk to me a bit about what it's like growing up being gay and what you experienced.
You're so right, and it's such an important point. So I probably always knew that I was gay, but it didn't mean anything until I became a teenager. And I started in that time to feel immense amounts of shame, internalized homophobia. And I, in some ways, was actually very lucky. I never experienced homophobia from my world. It was always from the world around me, from the news, the media, people at school, but never my family, never friends of mine, you know, close friends of mine. But I certainly absorbed that shame, and I felt like I was broken, that there was something wrong with me. And that realization that I mentioned when I was first speaking, that I had done nothing wrong, was immensely powerful, because prior to that, I thought I had done something wrong. I'm the problem, I thought. Okay, it's my behavior. This is the issue. As opposed to, no, this is the world's problem and I've done nothing wrong and it really has nothing to do with me. And you're right, that realization was, you know, or the process which led to pride from that realization, let's say, was many years in the making. It wasn't like I woke up the next day and was like, I'm proud, this is great. No, it took a really long time, because you have to dismantle the way you see the world, the shame that you have absorbed, internalized homophobia. But I really thought at that time that I had no choice. I was like, if I don't pursue pride, if I fight, right, then I will survive. If I don't fight these feelings, I literally will not survive. And we know that LGBTQ plus kids are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide than their heterosexual counterparts, right? So there's a real kind of fight for your life happening there. And I just had to fight. I just understood at some point, okay, there's nothing wrong with me, so I need to fight this. I need to fight the shame. I need to fight for my self-determination as a young gay person.
What's the historical context of the LGBTQ plus community claiming pride? It just didn't appear overnight, but what's the evolution of pride being the mantra of the gay community?
I would say that it was post-Stonewall in 1969. There were LGBTQ plus rights movements in Germany, actually, pre-war. There was a gay Jew called Magnus Hirschfeld who had an institute who was, you know, kind of working to have LGBTQ plus people be accepted in German society at that point. But really, the modern pride movement was born in America after the Stonewall riots in 1969. And I'm sure there were kind of rumblings all over the world, right? But what happened in America was so significant, and people often say Pride was a riot, that young people in Stonewall, which was a gay club in New York City, they fought back. The police tried to raid and they fought back. And it was a reclamation of power, of strength, an expression of anger. And it was one that led to kind of what we see today. But yeah, no, it didn't just come out of nowhere. It was fought for. And I think that some people forget that today, that actually our, you know, gay LGBTQ plus predecessors, they fought for this.
So where does the analogy begin and where does the analogy end with your now claim to want to be the founder of the Jewish Pride movement today? What are the similarities, or when did you see those similarities, and how are you playing them out?
So I saw the similarities, as I said, during the Corbyn experience, and it was really based on the idea that when I was a young person, as a Jew, as a Jewish person, I was told, keep your head down, don't say anything. Don't rock the boat, just get on with it. And I understood, you know, through research and reading and understanding the LGBTQ plus experience, that that probably was the wrong approach. A, I don't think it works for Jews, and also B, it doesn't empower us. In terms of the similarities, I think there certainly are similarities. I think that both communities have to deal with the idea of passing. So passing as members of the majority, that is something that both LGBTQ plus people and Jews can experience. And there's a whole myriad of things that come along with that. And I think that, like any minoritized community, we have absorbed shame. So in that regard, there's similarity as well, right? But that speaks to the general minoritized community. I'm sure there are other experiences that are similar, or there are similarities to be drawn. But for me, the kind of most obvious one was passing. Because I understood, you know, people would talk to me about passing as a white person. I'll be very clear, on the census, I don't tick white, I tick other and write Jewish. And sometimes people will say to me, but you are white. And firstly, I think that that is tremendously rude, that I actually get to define my own identity, especially as I'm a thoughtful person who works in this space. You know, there's reasoning behind it. Someone might not agree, but that's okay. But often I find non-Jewish people telling me who and what I am. You know, no, you are white, or Jews are a religion, which is, again, something I would disagree with. And I think similarly, well, I would say that, you know, that was one experience I described. And I guess what I just described actually is the dichotomy, is not the similarity, is the difference. So I will answer your question, I promise, David. But that thought just came to mind, that I tell people I'm a Jew and I don't tick white, and they immediately say to me, but you are white. Whereas I say to people that I'm gay, and they ask me often, not always, but often, how should I refer to you? Are you gay, queer, LGBTQ+, what are your pronouns, right? So as a gay person, I'm given the space to define my identity, but as a Jew, I'm not. So that is a difference. And in terms of passing, what I meant to say before I kind of, my mind went on a little journey there, was people say that to pass is a privilege. And I understand that passing allows you to circumvent certain types of prejudice, certain types of oppression. It's absolutely true. But I do not think it's a privilege. I think that it's another form of oppression, because I think having to hide yourself is a form of oppression. And I would tell the story, when I was a young person, I was passing as straight. Most people in my life had no idea that I was gay, but I was tormented. I really was driven mad by the shame, by the trauma of this experience. So kind of, I would say to someone, would you say to that child that they were privileged because they weren't receiving direct or overt homophobic abuse? No, you wouldn't. So what we need to do is understand the kind of the nuance in the experience of oppression. So that is one similarity there. Got there in the end. Yeah.
No, but so many questions. All right. So tangent, and then I want to come back to that. You did mention really briefly that Jews are not a religion, or not just a religion. Just go for that for a second, just so our audience understands where you're coming from on that point.
Sure. So I would argue that Jews are not a religion. I understand that some people will say we're not just a religion, and that's fine, right? Like, we don't need to be prescriptive. We can all have our own ways to define. The reason I would say that we're not a religion, I would say that we're a people or a civilization who have a religion, who have a God. And that's very different from, say, Islam or Christianity. The Jewish God, from an anthropological perspective, is defined as a national God. So it's really my kind of my own identity and my work is really rooted in Jewish peoplehood.
Very, very helpful. Now, I'm loath to say I understand and empathize with the torment you described growing up being gay. I can empathize with it, but I don't fully get it, right? As a white straight guy growing up in Australia, that's not an experience that I am familiar with from a personal, but I do empathize with it. I find it difficult to believe that they were exactly the same experiences you were having as a Jew growing up in Glasgow, right? And here I want to get to the question, because I think it's important. Are you one of those people that believe that ultimately the whole world is out to get the Jews? And how does anti-Semitism sit in the world? Because I think for much of the gay community growing up, especially in the 60s and 70s when you're talking about Stonewall, etc., that was a perception that there was so much homophobia that it really was fully directed. Is that the same current era that you feel the Jewish community is in today? And your responses to it would make sense if that's the case, but I'm not sure it's exactly there.
No, I do think that.
Okay.
And it's not that I think that every single person hates us. I genuinely don't. I mean, I would say this is kind of an amusing thing to say. My partner is not Jewish, right? So it's like, my best friend is Jewish. My partner is not Jewish. You know, I have many very close relationships with non-Jewish people who are wonderful allies. And I know that they are committed to supporting the Jewish people and do not hold those beliefs. What I believe is that the Western world as a civilization, and I think the Muslim world too, but you know, we're having this conversation in the West, the Western world was built on Jew hatred. And I would say, I'm not going to take credit for this work. That's not my work. That's David Nuremberg, who wrote Anti-Judaism, the Western Tradition. And what he does in that really brilliant book is explain how Jew hatred became a foundation or played a foundational role in Christianity and then the West. So it's not that I think every single person hates us, but do I think the world hates us? Yeah, large pockets of it. I think I probably would say that.
Is that a later realization for you? Or do you think you realized that earlier? Because I have followed your work for a few years now, and it seems like, I don't want to give it a label to it, but it seems like you've tilted to more of that line of thinking more in recent times, especially in a post-October 7 world, but that's another category in some ways.
No, it was a gradual realization, but beyond October 7th. The first line of my first book is "The non-Jewish world hates Jews" is something my late father used to tell me. And that was published in 2021 and I started writing it in 2019. So it is something I've believed for a while, but it wasn't something I believed as a young person, because you're exactly right. That experience I had growing up as a gay person was not the same as the one I had growing up as a Jew. They were really completely different in many ways. And I kind of was born at the tail end of this, you know, post-Holocaust period where overt anti-Semitism was still taboo. I don't think that exists anymore, that period.
So Ben, besides being besides being an advocate, you're also an educator. And I'm really interested in the educational piece of what it means to teach about pride, and in this case, particularly Jewish pride. I mean, if we take that most education has some sort of cognitive, affective, and behavioral components, how would you go about educating about Jewish pride?
So I would do three things, or I would look at three different components. And I talk about the head, the hands, and the heart. So the head is really the educational piece, exactly what you're talking about. We have to know our story. I'm writing a book right now, my third book, called The Jews and Indigenous People. And I obviously had a fair idea of what I wanted to say going into it, right? You generally do when you write a book. But I've done an enormous amount of research and I've learned a huge amount. And in that learning, my understanding of the Jewish experience has deepened and my own relationship with it has deepened. Because pride is not something, particularly Jewish pride, is not something intangible. It should be based on real knowledge, right? Understanding the Jewish story. And of course, Jews will debate about what that story is, and that's fine, but at least we have to be coming with evidence. That's what I would always say to my students. They might have said to me, "Mr. Freeman, I think this." And I'd say, "Why do you think that? Show me the evidence. Where, cite your sources," right? It's kind of the cliche thing teachers say, but it's really true. So we have to come to those dialogues, those conversations with knowledge. And to me, particularly knowledge regarding, and I mentioned it earlier, Jewish peoplehood. Deviating slightly from the traditional idea of educating us through a religious lens. I don't think that we disregard that. I think it's deeply important. But I think there's another story to be told alongside it. And that story can be proven or at least discussed through archaeology or epigraphic evidence, right? It's that kind of secular story that I'm interested in. So we have to educate about it. Like it's simple. We have to know facts about the Jewish experience. We need to know there really was a kingdom of Israel in the north and a kingdom of Judah in the south, and that Jews take their name from the kingdom of Judah, obviously also the tribe of Judah. And I can only speak for myself and say that process of learning has only enriched my identity. The second aspect would be to encourage And this is, you know, less academic, but encourage Jewish action. And I'm a secular Jew. I'm not religious. I wear two McGinn David necklaces. I'm not sure if people can see me in this video. I usually wear a kippah if I've done my hair. I'm wearing a baseball cap right now. And I wear a kippah because I want to mark myself as a Jew. I'm proud of it. I don't want to hide. I don't want to be ashamed. And it's my right as a Jew. Some people say to me, oh, I didn't know that you were observant. I didn't know you were Orthodox. It's like, I'm not. But secular Jews also own Jewish action. And we have to understand that, as has been the case, and again, this fits into the knowledge perspective, as has been the case for thousands of years, Jewishness has been expressed through action. It's not about faith. It's not even really about belief, in my opinion. It's about how Jews behave. And there are certain things that Jews do that mark us as a unique set of people. So there's that. And then the last part is kind of maybe the most challenging to teach, but I think it's something that we would have to spend years cultivating. And it's that emotion, because pride is an emotion. You know, we're talking here about education, and that education feeds this feeling. Pride is a feeling. So we have to also cultivate that. So telling young Jewish people that to be Jewish is wonderful, you're part of this unbroken cultural chain, you're part of something unique. And by the way, all people are unique. I'm not saying that we're better, it's just that we're also a unique civilization, and that Jews today all around the world are all doing the same thing. On particular moments, you know, I can think of, I was on tour in the United States and I was speaking at a synagogue, so I was at their Shacharit service, and I thought, every Jewish community is reading the same Parsha today. Like, that to me is incredible. So the knowledge and the action can feed this feeling.
I want to press you a bit on the Jewish content piece here, because there are so many Jewish educators who I know listen to this podcast and are going to say, so what does that actually mean for me? And I think you're touching on a really critical piece here. Now, maybe you're a bit subjective because you've declared yourself not to be a religious Jew here, but I think you're making a pretty big claim that Jewish history, or a sociological understanding and a historical understanding of the Jewish people, is as important, if not more important, than some other more traditional aspects of what have fallen into Jewish educational settings.
I'm not going to rank them, because even I really genuinely haven't figured that out myself yet, but it is absolutely 100% as important. And I'm very strong in this. We are doing our young people, and indeed every aspect of our community, an enormous disservice by not teaching it, because there is a real story to be told. And that is what the most, to me, that is my priority, right? Again, people are entitled, especially as educators, to have their priority, their agenda. But I think to fail to teach it would be an enormous error. And by the way, I think that someone in my position, a secular Jew focusing on the history, I should also teach the Torah. So it's not that you separate and you say, okay, I'm not teaching that or that. No, you teach them together. You teach them in tandem. And yes, sometimes there might be contradiction, but even, you know, I'm writing this book about Jewish indigeneity, and there's these chapters devoted to Jewish history. And sometimes the archaeology doesn't look like it proves what the Torah says. And I say it doesn't matter, because there was a sense of self, a sense of identity. Right, if you believe that God wrote the Torah, then I understand you'll have trouble with what I just said, so totally fine. I respect that, but we'll have to agree to disagree. I don't believe that God wrote the Torah. I believe that it was written or compiled by Judahite scribes in the southern kingdom of Judah. And to me, it doesn't matter whether it's historically 100% as the Torah says or not. A, I think the Torah contains huge memory, so I don't think it's made up, number one. But even if there are embellishments or, you know, artistic license taken, the people who are writing it had a sense of self, which to me is remarkable. So it's not that you push the Torah aside, you say we're not teaching that. No, you do teach it. I just think you also teach the historical aspect. And I say in my book, Indigeneity, we're uncovering a layer of identity which already exists. The history is there, so we should know it. We should know our story, not least because other people insist on telling our story for us. So how can we say, no, actually, this is what it means to be a Jew if we don't know?
I'm also interested in your aspect of you talking about how you teach the emotion of what it means to be connected to the Jewish people. You mentioned things which are somewhat amorphous in some ways about those intangibles that we want to be able to convey to our young people especially. But you and I both know from our own life experiences that immersive experiences, or getting people to experience something for themselves, even though it could have an unintended consequence, is probably the best way we know to obtain an emotional connection to anything.
I totally agree. That's why you have the hands. And I think you're right. Like, it's hard to teach. I actually don't think it is hard to teach. Rather, I would say it takes a really long time. It's not like, again, you teach one lesson on Jewish pride and everyone's like, I've got no internalized anti-Semitism, I feel so proud. No, it is something we have to commit to as a community, to be starting when they're in kindergarten, right the way through they're in the Jewish educational system, whatever that looks like. This repetition of pride, of empowerment, of inspiration, of strength, of power, and an understanding of self. It's self-esteem, self-confidence.
What happened to your philosophy and beliefs around Jewish pride post-October 7th?
I would say that it became even more important. And I will say, it's not that being proud stops you feeling the pain or the trauma. In some ways, actually, I think it might make you feel it more. So that first week after October 7th, I really was a complete mess. It was grief like I've never experienced before. But since the shock of that has subsided slightly, it has made me understand that pride is more important now than ever. I also want to say, pride is not just a form of resistance. We don't just do it because we've experienced terrible things. We do it because we see the innate value in being a Jew. But in times like this, it also takes on a new significance, especially when we're seeing horror at what happened on October 7th in Israel, but also horror at the diaspora. You know, I live in London. It's no joke to be living here right now. I was with my best friend earlier and her sister messaged her when we were at lunch saying, oh, there's a huge, violent, aggressive, in her perspective, violent pro-Palestinian protest outside her work. That's what we're living with on a day-to-day basis here. I wear these two Magen David necklaces and I see people looking at them and they don't look particularly pleased I'm wearing them. So having a sense of self, having self-esteem, having self-confidence, having pride at this time is more important now than ever, because we have to understand that lesson that I learned as a kid in Glasgow. We've done nothing wrong. We've done nothing to deserve this. This is an expression of non-Jewish hate. It's not a Jewish problem, actually. Jew hatred is a non-Jewish problem. It impacts us, of course, but it's their issue. And I think there's something actually very freeing in that, because then we stop looking for their validation. We say we will integrate. We will be American, Australian, British, and we will be part of society. And we will, you know, also have that identity. We're not willing to diminish our Jewishness, to check it at the door. We're not going to be progressives if we have to leave our Zionism at the door. No, we're going to occupy the space which is ours to claim as proud, strong Jews who know our worth.
I guess I have to ask you the follow-up question. You've been involved in many progressive movements over time. Did you feel like so many American Jews in that space have also felt a sense of abandonment from some of your allies in a post-October 7 world?
Absolutely. And I think I will say, this has been a long time coming. I'm not sure if you're saying it like this, but I would say there is a pre-October 7th and a post-October 7th. I think it has changed the paradigm. However, these trends were already in place. But yes, I've heard for years, and particularly after October 7th, Jews being devastated. And this is the thing. Jew hatred is not a theory. It has a real impact on us. It impacts our self-esteem, our self-perception, our value, or our sense of our value. So Jews who have been psychologically traumatized or scarred or devastated, feeling that they have not been supported when they have for so long supported others. And I think that my ethos is, I don't go to parties I'm not invited to. I'm not going to stay in those specific spaces if they're not also welcoming and supportive of me, but that doesn't change my values. It doesn't change how I approach the world. It just impacts where I spend my time and where I put my energy.
Interesting that you say that, because I think that answer sits really well with me and my understanding of your role in the physical world. But in social media, you've got a bit of a different presence where you are entering into a space where you're not always welcome.
Yeah,
so talk to us a bit about your role and your presence in social media and your movement on social media to really try and galvanize Jews and others to understand the Jewish pride movement as well.
Yeah, I mean, social media is a key component of it, because I was a Jew living in Hong Kong. Now I'm a Jew living in London, and you're based where? New York City?
Brooklyn, New York.
There we go, right? It's like, it's kind of an incredible thing, social media. It also has its downfalls, as we know. I use social media to primarily speak to Jews. I always want to empower and educate and inspire the same things I want to do to Jews. I want to do that for non-Jewish people. But even in my books, I say very clearly that this is for a Jewish audience, and I want non-Jews to come on the journey with us and listen and learn. But I speak primarily to Jews. And sometimes people say to me, oh, you have to speak to non-Jews. And I say, what I'm trying to do here is build Jewish pride, which I think can fight Jew hatred, but I'm not really here trying to fight Jew hatred. They are slightly different things, although there is, of course, a close relationship. And yeah, the online world can be very toxic. But what I try to do is I try to say what I really believe and say what I think. And that is not to say that I get it right every time. I look back at some of my tweets and I'm like, ooh, that was an inelegant way to express that thought that I had. I try to be very introspective about the tweets because I'm aware that I'm putting something out into the world. And again, I don't always get it right, but I want to speak to Jews. I want to educate Jews, inspire and empower Jews online. And online is such an unbelievable force. And I think that we've seen Jewish pride be successful. We've seen people put proud Jew in their social media bios, new accounts pop up on Instagram, Twitter that are solely devoted to Jewish pride and these ideas. We have a long way to go, but social media has been an incredible tool. But it can be tricky to navigate because you get, I mean, quite simply, we're outnumbered. I'm thinking of Hamilton in my head, right? Outgunned, outmanned, whatever the line is. We're outnumbered. So that is immensely challenging. And it does have an effect on you. Again, being a proud Jew doesn't make you not feel the power of the Jew hatred you're experiencing.
It's also interesting to me that you're focusing here on inspiring, empowering Jews, because I do also think that there's an element of your work which is also subversive within the Jewish community as well. And you've come out quite explicitly recently, and, well, I'll read you a quote that you've actually written, which you've said, parts of the Jewish leadership have failed. It's not that they failed to stop the rise of Jew hate, that's beyond their control, but there are those who failed in a very real way to equip the Jewish community with knowledge and pride in order to navigate the world in which we find ourselves. And that's a pretty harsh condemnation of Jewish leadership.
Oh, I mean, that was an edited condemnation of Jewish leadership. It was much harsher. I think that we need to have a serious conversation about the failings in our community. And when I speak of failings, this may sound contradictory, I'm not really here to judge. I understand why people did what they did. I have empathy for their actions, but we also have to recognise, A, the world has changed. There has been a paradigm shift before October 7th, but certainly after October 7th. But also the writing has been on the wall for years. The Jeremy Corbyn crisis started in 2015. That was 9 years ago. The writing has been on the wall and people look the other way. They didn't understand it. They were focused perhaps on right-wing Jew hatred, particularly in America, less so what's happening on the left. And I think that I'm not here to say that they're bad people or to shame them or judge them, but we're at war and we need leaders who understand what is happening and who are willing to do what needs to be done, which in my opinion, obviously, is educate and inspire. Like, I'm really privileged. I travel the world either in person or online and I have conversations with Jews. And one of the things they say to me during my events is, why didn't we know this? And you're right, it's not good enough. And like any corporation who gets audited, we have to start having conversations because, you know, what I will say, there are lots of organizations, and by the way, I work with a lot of them. So it's not a black and white thing of good and bad. There is good work being done, even if I don't think it's enough. But there's a lot of organizations who have enormous budgets who I don't think are using them in the most effective way. And I'm just one person. Other people will have different perspectives, and I totally understand that, especially as Jews, by the way, come on. But yeah, I think there has been a really critical failing. And again, I want to repeat what I said in that quote you read. It's not that they fail to stop Jew hatred. That is out of their control. So I'm not sitting here being like, hey, why didn't all of these different organizations stop this? I don't think they could have done. But what they could have done was educate. And in my opinion, educate properly, which means both the Torah and the historical aspect. So both, not one or the other, but both. And to inspire people. The message of keep your head down, That is an unhealthy message to give a young person. Let's just say that. That's my most diplomatic way of saying that.
Ben, you're pretty persuasive, and yet you have had a bit of pushback from the Jewish community.
I mean, sure, we're Jews. We love to argue. Why not?
So what are some of the biggest pushbacks? What are some of the biggest obstacles you get in trying to push out your Jewish pride movement?
I think that some people don't get it. I think there's a generational shift that needs to happen. And I don't actually mean generational in terms of age. I just mean in terms of mindset. I think the traditional mindset is we need to fight anti-Semitism. How do you do that? It's enormously difficult, particularly because to fight anti-Semitism, you have to speak to non-Jews. So how are we going to change the curriculum in the non-Jewish public school system? Or how are we going to impact all of those things, right? It's not that it's wrong. I think it's just not necessarily realistic. To me, the realistic work should be Jewish pride. And that does help the fight against Jew hatred, because proud, empowered, knowledgeable Jews understand that they deserve better and they're going to fight. But to me, that's kind of the biggest thing I see, is that people say, what you do is great and interesting, but we want to fight anti-Semitism. And I say, with all due respect, haven't Jews wanted to fight anti-Semitism for 2,000 years?
I actually do see your language as being generational in many ways, but not necessarily about people, but about institutional and communal life and the resistance of communities or institutions who are willing to change to meet these new realities. I do see that as being generational.
I totally agree with you. And I think that Jewish pride is quite a radical idea when we consider the rhetoric that existed in the Jewish community of keep your head down, right? I was not the only person who experienced that. Not everyone did. But that was certainly something I hear expressed across the Jewish world. There was this encouragement to be good Jews. And Jewish pride essentially is to say, no, we're not going to be good Jews. We're not going to be bad Jews. We're going to be Jews, and we will define what that means. We're not going to be told what it means to be Jewish. And that is radical. It is scary for people who have trauma, who might think, actually, to raise our heads above the parapet is frightening because what happens when we will? So I have great empathy to that. I just think keeping our heads down, A, doesn't work, and B, it's also not healthy. And when I say healthy, I mean how we feel about ourselves. To feel strong, to feel pride, to feel that you deserve to take up space, I think that is the best way for us to move forward.
All right, to be totally transparent here, this is one of those like aha moments where this is now just clicking for me, right? I knew I wanted to get you onto the podcast because pride, I think, has become a bit of a platitude and a cliche. And everyone has said, especially after October 7th, we needed to educate a whole generation of Jews to be proud of being Jewish. And we've said that for a long time, but you describing it now as actually being radical, and before I use the word as subversive, I think is part of the conversation that I really wanted to get at today, to understand that this is not business as usual, that if you're to take this movement seriously, and by having you here, getting to expand the reach of your work to so many other educators, I do think it is asking some of the more difficult, deep-rooted questions of Jewish education and Jewish institutional life. I really appreciate you shedding light on that for me and for hopefully our listeners as well.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on. And I think that this is why this conversation is so important, because you're right. Pride can seem flighty. It can seem intangible, like a fun thing. No, it is. It is incredibly real. It changes lives. And we actually are in an incredibly fortunate position. And let me explain why. When I kind of came to LGBTQ+ pride, I was not in a gay community. The world around me was heterosexual. I had to pursue knowledge and community and understanding. We're born into a community. We're born with an infrastructure which educates young people. It's just, we have to ask the questions. What are we trying to achieve? And again, I think that we should teach the Torah. I'm a secular Jew and I absolutely think that we should teach the Torah. Why? Because the Torah is also my legal code. I think secular Jews give everything away and I think it's really problematic. The Torah belongs to me just as much as it belongs to an Orthodox Jew, say. But alongside, there is a real story to be told. And I can only speak for myself, but writing this book, the one I'm writing right now, The Jews and Indigenous People, and doing the research and learning more has been really profound, because I see, and you spoke about action, right? That is one of the most important things, and you're absolutely right. And what action does is connect us to the past. So the idea of lighting the Shabbat candles, the idea of the prayers, it all connects us not only to each other, but to the land of Israel, and our ancestors. There is this unbroken continuum, which really just blows my mind.
Ben, we've had this question asked of all of our guests on Adapting. Is there an educator in your life, someone who's inspired or even perhaps transformed you and led you on this journey?
I would say yes. My history teacher at school, who I will not name them to maintain their privacy, not that it would make an enormous difference because they're not Jewish, actually, which is, I think, an interesting person for me to choose. But this was my history teacher, and she made history real and accessible. And I think what I'm able to do is talk about history, but kind of tell these stories in a way which relates to people today. And I kind of try to humanize the people of the past. And that is something I learned from this specific teacher. But, you know, it's also every educator that I've come into contact with has shaped me. Because I think what we have to be, or the way you have to approach the world, is openness. Like, there's clearly some things that I'm very, like, dogmatic on, right? Like, we're not going to pretend. But also, I want to be open enough and have humility so that someone who I disagree with can still inspire me, can still change me, change my perspectives. I have someone else I'd like to say who isn't really, he's not a formal educator. And I will say his name because he is Jewish. I think that he would get a kick out of this. His name is Winston. And I refer to Winston as my Dumbledore. And everything I write, for the most part, is seen by Winston before it's published. Every thought I have, I share with him. Like, I'm so lucky to have someone who is as obsessed with this as I am and wants to go there. I mean, you kind of spoke about this conversation going there, right? You really have to go there and have the real conversation. And he is someone who, through his brilliance, not only has educated me and made me see the world in a different way, but he's done something which I think all educators should do, and he's empowered me. He gave me the strength and the confidence to share my voice. Because you got to remember, I'm writing my third book right now, which is great. Back in 2019, I was just a boy with a laptop and a dream. Like, who was I to write a book? I was a teacher. I was not a writer. But because I had someone like him in my life saying, no, go for it, that gave me the confidence. And I do think the aim of leadership and education is to create more leaders, to create more people who feel able to share their voice. So I'm very lucky to have Winston, my Dumbledore.
I feel a bit trite saying that this has been a lot of fun, but it has been, because I really have only known you through your words and through your writing, and to get to know and speak with you in person has really brought to life many of the things which drew me to this conversation in the first place. I want to thank you for agreeing to be part of Adapting. I know how busy you are and your travel schedule is pretty intense, but also for just being so open and so reflective on what you're sharing. And I really hope that our audience gets a chance to read some of your work, to follow you on X or Instagram, I think is where you're most prolific at the moment, and have a chance to hear you in person when you're traveling to a community near there. So Ben, thank you so much for joining us on Adapting today.
Thank you so much for having me. This has really been truly a pleasure.
Today's episode was produced by Dina Nussbaum and Mirandela Peters. The show's executive producers are myself, Karen Cummins, and Nessa Lieben. Our show is engineered and edited by Nathan J. Vaughan of NJV Media. If you enjoyed Adapting this season, please leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, and even better still, share it with a friend. To learn more about the Jewish Education Project, please visit us at jewishedproject.org. There you can learn more about our mission, history, and staff, as well as the many programs that we're offering, particularly in response to October 7th. And as always, we are a proud partner of UJA Federation of New York. Thank you, as always, for listening today.